Hello, 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 and welcome to the Velvet Studio, home of Ottawa's Queen Media. Yes, yeah, we had a bit of trouble with the headphones, but there we go. All good. We are joined on the line, now this is me hoping that it works, by Graham Reid. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I am thrilled that that works. Sometimes, you know, I've had some days where things work perfectly, and some days when that is possibly the opposite of what's happening.
So, well, you did dial him in before we even turned on the theme
song. I know,
song,
which yeah. is also kind of good planning. Unusual for me. So, yes, Graham Reid, thank you for joining us. You're the director of the LGBT rights program at Human Rights Watch. And thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Just before we do all this, Luke, we forgot to introduce the topic.
And ourselves, yes.
And ourselves.
Okay, well, that's fine.
But we introduced Graham, so that's very gracious of you as a host.
Excellent. Well, my name is Luke Smith, and you're listening to The Velvet Studio.
I'm Sebastian, and this is week 3 in...
Refugee Month.
Refugee Month, where we're talking about intersectional issues between the LGBTQ peoples.
Yeah.
And refugeeism, I guess, would be the...
I don't think it's religion.
No.
Yeah, just, you know, folks affected by.
Refugee-ness.
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah, along those lines. Yeah. Point being, in week one, for the sake of our listeners, we had Michael Cansasola of the Resettlement Officer with UNHCR join us. In week two, we had Nicholas Hirsch, a local human rights lawyer, local immigration lawyer, mm-hmm. Talking about how do you prove that you are gay to the Refugee Board. Of Canada. And now we're talking about what kind of drives folks to become refugees. What are the push factors? Mm-hmm. Looking quite specifically at forced anal examinations. So for folks listening who may be a little faint of heart, we will give you a bit of a heads up that will be the topic of conversation.
Well, one of them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The reason why we've got you folks on the line here is because you put a report out on July 12th called Dignity Debased, Forced Anal Examinations in Homosexuality Prosecutions. How did that report kind of come about?
You know, it came about for a range of reasons. One of them is that we were shocked to learn how widespread this practice was, despite being based on completely discredited science from the 19th century, and that it was used quite frequently in a number of countries in court cases to prove homosexuality. So that was the one reason, is that this was taking place, and clearly it's in contravention of international law. And secondly, we found that in countries in which there was very repressive practices towards gay people, is that in some instances, the ministries of health were equally disapproving of the fact that these practices were taking place under their watch. So we felt that there was room for change, and we recognized it as a widespread problem that needed to change.
So when you say the ministries of health, you mean the ministries of health in the countries where this is happening. So even the feds in the different countries where this is happening, they disapprove as well?
I'm saying that in some instances we found individuals within the ministries of health who were equally opposed to these kinds of practices. I'm not saying uniformly, because yeah. clearly these practices are taking place with medical personnel involved. And in some instances, the people who are involved don't see it as a problem. But, for example, in Cameroon, where there are a number of arrests of people who are suspected of being gay, and where anal exams take place, there within the Ministry of Health were people who were opposed to this practice. So we thought we could work with those ministries in order to educate people about what these exams are about, why they're against international law, why they are regarded as a form of cruel, degrading, and inhuman treatment, and why they should stop.
Now, you, when I say you, Human Rights Watch have put together a 3-minute video. So we're going to play a bit of that, because I think the video does a really good job of giving a bit of a backgrounder. And there are interviews with folks speaking in their native tongue. Now, there are subtitles, but of course we can't subtitle live radio. So we will make it available on the website, and we'll fade out once we get to that portion of the video. But I think it is a really good job of kind of priming the conversation. So we'll get back to the conversation just after this.
Forced anal examinations on men and transgender women who are suspected of homosexuality. We found that in at least 8 countries around the world, police colluding with doctors subject people who are suspected of homosexuality to these horribly humiliating exams.
ديجا قلت لك احاول هبط لي سروالي طلعوني معناتها فوق طاوله هكا عاون هبط لي سروالي وعاون شد لي ضيق والطبيب من الاول معناتها حط صبعه ومن بعد فما حاجه كيف اباري كيما الباي كيما الباي.
Do it the way they wanted it to be done. Yeah.
For police officers to ask that tests be done forcibly on individuals, just, you know, one or another to prove that they may have participated in a homosexual act, I think that is not acceptable. And in fact, that sort of evidence, even where it is collected, is completely unreliable.
Anal exam cannot tell you if you're homosexual or not, whether you're passive or you're active. This is just the biggest lie ever created in the history of medicine. You cannot prove a person is gay through any of those exams at all.
As a lawyer, I do think that the use of forced or non-consensual anal exams is torture. It is degrading. It is inhuman. More especially given the fact that the method used for carrying out anal exams are unscientific, and it appears calculated simply to abuse the dignity of the people who are being interviewed.
These countries should look to the fact that given that prohibiting same-sex conduct is a violation of international law, they should take every step possible to ensure that people who are arrested under these kinds of laws are not subjected to additional forms of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment that further violate their rights.
So yeah, we had I think that was a great primer on, I think, some of the key issues here. You mentioned at the top of the hour that this came from a 19th century practice. You know, I find it hard to fathom how people could believe that it would actually prove anything. So, you know, where did this concept come from?
Well, you know, it's from these highly discredited, very archaic sources that originated, as we understand it, in France. But, you know, they are so implausible, and, you know, that of course the overwhelming scientific and medical knowledge regards them as completely useless from any point of medical or forensic point of view. And yet they persist. There was a 19th century forensic doctor who published a book in 1857 called The Forensic Assault of Assaults Against Decency. And in the book, he spelled out 6 characteristic signs of what he called habitual pedestry. And that's the earliest account that a researcher who worked on a 2003 report on Egypt found as the origin, the medical origin of these theories. And it's puzzling that it persists to this day. Now, of course, underlying these tests is the law that prohibit same-sex practice. But usually the law requires for people to be caught in the act in order to prove that same-sex conduct took place. So in a way, these tests are concocted with the idea that somehow one could prove that that same-sex practice took place, a same-sex encounter took place without actually being witness to that encounter. So, of course, the real underlying problem here is the existence of laws that prohibit consensual same-sex conduct between members of the same sex.
Now, are there judiciaries in these countries accepting this as evidence? When you're saying that it's been deemed as, in some cases, as a form of sexual assault or as a form of torture, how are judiciaries accepting that or not?
Well, that's the question that we're asking in the report, because they do and they are. And they shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And that's the point that we're making in this report, is that these tests show nothing, they prove nothing, they're medically useless, they're forensically completely unreliable, and they have no place in a court of law. And yet they are used as evidence in these various jurisdictions that we outline in the report. In the report, we cover 8 countries, and in each country setting, there is a different approach and a different situation. In some countries, such as Egypt and Tunisia, they're used in a routine fashion. In other countries, such as Kenya, we only have one documented case, although it's a current case in which these tests have been used. And there was a recent challenge to the use of these tests, precisely for the reasons that you allude to, is that they are useless, and that they also, in themselves, the actual conducting the test constitutes a human rights violation, so that they are contrary to the Kenyan constitution, was the argument. Unfortunately, in that case, the judge upheld that there was indeed consent given, although, as we argue in the report, is that the question of consent in these circumstances is impossible to give consent when you're in police custody, and when you're required to take the test in order to prove your guilt or innocence in terms of the law.
It certainly is not a position that anyone really should find themselves in. I want to point out, just for our listeners' sake, that it's not quite all doom and gloom. You highlight Lebanon in the report as being a country where historically this practice was used, but they're trying to stamp it out. Are we seeing improvements, or is Lebanon just an anomaly?
Well, we were certainly inspired by Lebanon, because activists in Lebanon were very savvy. They launched a campaign against these tests, which were used routinely, and they called them the tests of shame. And they raised public awareness and opposition to the use of these tests. And the Lebanese Order of Physicians asked the Ministry of Justice to issue guidelines to prohibit the use of the forced anal exam. And so those, by and large, stopped in 2012, although our report suggests that in certain isolated incidents that there is still a persistence of this practice. But nevertheless, it showed a very positive development in Lebanon, and one that we hope that we can build on. And partly it's about raising awareness, because people often don't know that this is taking place, and certainly not the extent to which it's taking place. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the doctors who are conducting these tests are not doing so in a malicious way. There are incidents in which doctors seem to take some perverse pleasure in doing these kinds of tests, and that it is clearly very coercive and cruel. Other doctors are doing it as a kind of routine, as part of their work, because they're told that they have to do it and they have to generate this kind of evidence. Sometimes they find a negative result and sometimes they find a positive result. I don't know how they draw that distinction, but nevertheless they do. But You know, so partly in those instances, it's about raising an international consensus. So what we at Human Rights Watch really want to see is for these practices to be condemned at the level of the World Health Organization and other medical bodies that can provide very clear guidance to doctors that they should not, under any circumstances, participate in these practices.
Something that really baffles me is the doctors themselves, they have medical training. They are, in a sense, scientists, maybe not experimental exploratory scientists, but they apply science all the time. But if there's no scientific evidence for it, I'm baffled as to what it is that they're actually looking for when they're doing it. Some time ago, I as an academic, I come across a lot of bizarre articles, and many of them are off topic. It's basically the sort of academic's version of reading Wikipedia and one thing leads to another. But anyway, some time ago, I do remember reading a long-term study of the effects of receptive anal intercourse. And the only thing they found no difference in anything, in color, in muscle tone, in anything. They only found one difference, and that is in the first 5 seconds of the test. Gay men with a long history of being anally receptive were less tense than those who were not. And the doctors basically just said they're more used to it, they freak out less, whereas a lot of the straight men that they were studying, it was the first time anything had gone in there before, and they just weren't used to it. So, I mean, that's what the science shows, and I don't understand what it is that these doctors would be looking for, because, I mean, if they're trained on how to identify, I don't know, angioplasty or, you know, skin cancer versus just an ingrown hair, surely then they would have also had scientific training on this, but I'm not sure what it is that they're looking for. I mean, it's from the sounds of it, they don't even know what they're looking for. They're just sort of making it up as they go. I mean, do you have any insight on what it is they think they're doing? As opposed to what they're doing. What they're doing is woo science. It's made up. But what they think they're doing, do you know what I mean by the distinction?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Like, what are they actually fishing around for?
What do they think they're fishing around for?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yes. I mean, that's a very good question, and I don't have an answer to it. Because, as you say, this has no medical value. Some of the doctors admit that, that there is no, that the tests are useless. Some of the doctors who in fact do the testing that we at Human Rights Watch interviewed admit that they don't see any value to the tests, but they just do it as a kind of routine because that's what they have been told to do and that's what they've been doing for quite some time. So, then they come up with these results. Now, sometimes the benevolent doctors come up with relatively consistent negative results, and then those results are used for people to be released and to be found not guilty. Yeah. And in other times, the results are used to send people to prison.
So there's certainly quite a substantial moral element, really. Your freedom is at the hands of the gloved hands of a medical practitioner. Fishing about, and that must be a terrifying position to be in. And I think the interviews, some of which were on camera in the video on Human Rights Watch's website, we strongly recommend people go and check that out as people speak to those experiences. But it astounds me that there is so little evidence. And you've been working towards an international consensus on it. You mentioned the International Forensic Experts Group as describing it as a form of sex assault and rape, which it certainly could be described as that way. Has there been any luck with swaying the World Health Organization?
Look, I think that, this is something that we're going to be taking up both on a national level, having just recently released the report. We released the report in Geneva, and we did that deliberately to raise that level of international awareness around it. And we are working with and approaching different national medical health councils in all the countries affected and other countries in order to gradually build a consensus and to get a very strong statement and a clear and unambiguous statement from international bodies to condemn this practice. So that's something that we're working towards, both at a country level and internationally.
Now, the focus of today's show and of the month in general is looking at refugees. How would forced anal examinations, how would that motivate somebody to want to leave their country of origin?
Well, I think there are two things. Is that, you know, as you've noted, this is a very intrusive practice, and also most people who have experienced it experience severe trauma that lasts for a long time. One person from Lebanon who interviewed victims of forced anal exams said that, you know, when she interviewed a victim 3 years after the fact, he still found it difficult to talk about it because it was such a traumatic experience. And I think if you look at the video on the website, you will see some of the personal testimonies that shows just how traumatic the actual experience is. But underlying that is the threat of the law. And I think that is one of the big push factors for people to seek a safer environment in which to live. So where there are forced anal exams, there are also sodomy laws that prohibit same-sex practices. And that really is the driver of people leaving those countries, because they're always living under the shadow of the law, and that law could be implemented at any time, or the law can be used for purposes of blackmail and extortion, or simply to create a climate that is inhospitable to LGBT people. So I think it's both, you know, the tests are one factor, but underlying the tests is the legal framework that gives rise to tests like that. And that's the real driver of people leaving and seeking a better life elsewhere.
I think, for us it was important to highlight that LGBT refugees are not just coming from Syria, because a lot of the conversation is dominated by Syrian refugees, and rightly so, under the regimes that are in place. It's certainly an incredibly unsafe place to be for anybody, let alone for LGBT folks. In the report, it mentions that, let me just have a quick look here, Kenya, Uganda, and Zambia only recently began, well, relatively recently began this practice. You know, does this show an increase in kind of the persecution of LGBT folks in those countries? Is it getting worse? Is that why this practice has been introduced?
You know, it's a very interesting question, because clearly there's been a lot more in the last, say, 25 years, starting with President of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, making a very strong public condemnation of gay people in Zimbabwe, mm-hmm. and comparing them, saying that they were worse than pigs and dogs, if I remember the quote correctly from the book there. And since then, since that moment, there's been a lot of other leaders condemning LGBT people. Now, often that's done for very specific political ends. So in, you know, Nigeria, there's a law passed just before the election there. In Uganda, the anti-gay rhetoric and legislation often coincides with broader political developments where gay people or LGBT people become a very convenient scapegoat and are used politically by leaders to stoke up opposition to a small minority and distract attention from other developments in the country, whether they're political opposition or economic difficulties, etc. So we see that, but we've also seen an enormous growth of an LGBT movement in sub-Saharan Africa. So in some respects, I see that the increased rhetoric and in some senses the clampdown on LGBT people being also an indication of the development of a movement within the continent. So there's a positive way of seeing it as well, is that it's a testimony to the growth, the development, the visibility, the willingness of particularly a younger generation to come out and to be more vocal and more demanding of their own rights and place in society. And so there's a pushback against that. But I think we need to see them together, because there's certainly, you know, a vibrant movement. There's a lot of creativity and resilience amongst LGBT people in very difficult circumstances. And there have also been some positive developments recently. The African Commission on Human and People's Rights passed a resolution that condemns violence against LGBT people and calls for the perpetrators to be brought to justice. And earlier this year, there was a regional seminar that took place in South Africa that brought together various human rights commissions, some government officials, and others to talk about ways of reducing violence and giving meaning to the African Commission resolution. So there have, you know, there have also been positive developments despite the highly publicized rhetoric that we hear that is much more negative towards LGBT people.
I think you're absolutely right. Bad news tends to carry the headlines more so than anything else. You were more likely to hear of ISIS beheading folks than we are to hear of, I'm just looking at your website now, in Iraq there was a Shia cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, who,
yes,
you know, is calling against anti-LGBT violence, which is, you know, a great symbol to kind of rally around.
Yes, and very significant, particularly in the context of Iraq, because, you know, since 2009, we've documented the kinds of abuses that take place there, including kidnapping, execution, torture by militia groups. So to have such a prominent cleric making a statement that at least condemns violence is very significant.
Mm-hmm.
And we also saw an outpouring of condemnation in the aftermath of the Orlando massacre and a Security Council statement on that issue. So, you know, again, despite what can be seen as quite a bleak outlook, is that there are positive developments. And, you know, just this year, finally, the UN Human Rights Council has paved the way for the appointment of an independent expert who will look at discrimination and abuse against LGBT people internationally. And that's the first time that there would be a dedicated mechanism within the UN system that would look specifically at issues affecting people on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. So that's a very significant development, and that's, you know, been many, many years in the making of a number of activist groups working together within the UN, pushing for various resolutions, drawing attention to LGBT issues within the UN system, and insisting that the human rights of LGBT people needed to be treated in the same way as the human rights of anybody else, and to be dealt with in a systematic and ongoing way within the UN system. So that's a very important development that's taken place just this year.
I'm curious about, okay, so I'm thinking about just history in general and how these things tend to repeat themselves. And it's very tempting to look at what's happening in a lot of sub-Saharan Africa and say, well, you know, that's there and this is here. But fact is, the United States certainly, and Canada to a lesser degree, went through this as well in the 1950s and 60s when McCarthyism mm-hmm. associated homosexuality with communism and with being anti-institutional. And people were imprisoned, and people were in some cases lobotomized or forcibly castrated, and it was incredibly inconsistent as well as to whether or not doctors believed it did anything or whether or not it was enforced. But a lot of what's happening currently in the news, if you're looking at the Middle East and in Africa, is very similar to what happened in North America in the more 60s and 70s, where you had people like Rodney King and Malcolm X, like people from non-LGBT groups speaking out against violence against LGBT. And so this kind of Anyway, all of that preamble just to say, so there's a lot of UN groups and there's a lot of medical professionals, but I'm curious about other communities in the Middle East and in Africa who are not necessarily associated with an LGBT rights movement, who are helping to stand up for them. Because again, you know, as Luke pointed out, we don't really get a lot of that news here about other groups, about, I don't know, Christian organizations, or if you're looking at Iran, I mean, Zoroastrianism is a huge religion there. It's not spoken about as much, but I don't know, for all I know, there could be all these other groups that are stepping in and helping. And just if you look at the history of LGBT rights in the West, the sort of cohesion of, you know, feminism and racial deracializing the law and LGBT rights, they all just sort of go together. And I'm curious about how these things are. Is there that same harmony going on in Africa and the Middle East?
I mean, you raise such an important point, and it's always so important to remember that, is that the history of, you know, of what's happened in Western Europe and in North America, which is a very recent history.
Yeah. Well, and there's also the notion that you have a limited ability to predict the future if you know history.
Right.
Right.
Right. That's true. But, I think that should also be something that shapes activism internationally, is that recognition and knowledge and acknowledgement that there's not one region of the world that has, you know, is immune from that kind of homophobic history and practices that have been pretty recent, right? And some of them are ongoing, because it's certainly important not to be complacent or not to be to take the moral high ground as if these kinds of things haven't taken place in the West, which of course they have.
Oh, yes.
And I think that, you know, when we heard, say, for instance, Hillary Clinton's speech at the UN Human Rights Council, she went to great lengths and was very careful to point that history out and to acknowledge that the U.S. still doesn't have comprehensive non-discrimination legislation. Mm-hmm. It still has a long way to go. It still has to address, a lot of issues around discrimination against LGBT people. And we see, the controversies around access to facilities for transgender people, et cetera. So that's an ongoing history that we need to be mindful of. And, you know, Human Rights Watch, just this year, it brought out a report on the experience of transgender women in U.S. immigration detention. And we're bringing out a report on a school environment later this year, also in the U.S. So there's a lot to be done in the U.S. as elsewhere. But now I've gone on a preamble and kind of forgotten what the thrust
is. No worries. I think you bring up a good point, and I want to just remind folks that you're absolutely right. On your website, it says, you know, in Florida, you know, there's same-sex relations carries the sentence of 0 to 10 years. That's Florida.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I think there's a lot of things that's still on the books. Like, for example, in Canada, if you have
and the thing you have to remember, because it's we think of Florida as being, I mean, usually when people think of Florida, they might think of like either the snowbirds or like the bayou people in the north, the bad, you know, quote unquote bad part of Florida where the guns are and the beer and the people.
I was thinking of sunshine and beaches, but that's,
well, yeah, that's the thing. Florida has Miami. Like Miami is in a state.
We digress.
It's just so bizarre.
The point being, even Canada has some things in the books. For example, Section 152 of the Criminal Code, which speaks to anal intercourse. If there's more than two of you in a room, you are breaking the law.
Also, the way the law is written is that anal intercourse in Canada is strictly forbidden in all contexts, except for the following exceptions, and the exceptions encompass almost everyone. Yeah. And
unless there's two or more. It's between the ages of 16 and 18.
A really weird law. Yeah. And the phrasing is so bizarre as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, point being...
And, of course, the residual sodomy laws can't be enforced in the U.S., but just the fact that they remain on the books is insulting to a lot of people, and that they can be used as a sort of intimidatory tactic to this day. And they should go.
Absolutely. And I think it's... Although Africa, there are a lot of countries in Africa where they are terribly archaic laws, You know, that comes from a history of colonialism.
Yes, they all straight out of the British law.
Yeah, that's. I seem to spend a lot of time apologizing on behalf of some terrible predecessors. But it's you're right. I mean, and I think perhaps the West and Britain in particular needs to take some ownership and help to advocate to have these laws repealed. You know, and you know, the Queen is the head of the Commonwealth.
Yes, humility that they put them there in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, the Queen is the head of the Commonwealth, and a lot of these Commonwealth countries still have these laws on the books. I think it's ridiculous.
Yes.
And it's not all just Africa. That's the point I wanted to make. I mean, I'm looking at this in, like, the Cook Island. There are places in Asia, in some parts of South America, even though South America has had incredible improvements over the last few years.
Mm-hmm. And Russia as well. Some of the former Soviet countries as well, they're very vague and foggy. I didn't take the time to look this up, so this is totally from memory, but it's either Estonia or Lithuania, where it's very similar to Canada, where they have this weird law in the books that says strictly forbidden, but then it has a caveat that says it's totally okay, and the cops are kind of like, we don't know what we should do about this, but we have people with guns to catch, so we're going to focus on that because we don't care. But it's still on the books. It's really bizarre. I mean, this is not, again, this is not an African thing. This is an international thing to some degree.
To bring it back into the conversation, you know, I think it's important that we recognize that JLBT refugees don't just come from Syria.
Yes.
And the conflict that's happening there. But they come from a number of countries, such as the ones outlined in your report, where these practices are happening, or where laws, because you said, as you mentioned, this is rooted in anti-gay laws, where those laws are in place. In the work that Human Rights Watch is doing, what are some of the flashpoint areas that you've seen over the last couple of years outside of the Middle East?
You know, Jamaica is an example that springs to mind. I don't want to single out Jamaica as being unique, because it's not. But certainly, with the proximity to North America, there are a lot of Jamaicans who seek asylum in the U.S. And one of the issues that they raise is the high levels of violence within Jamaica. So gay men and lesbians and transgender people fleeing Jamaica because there's a buggery law in place, and there are very high levels of social intolerance and violence, and an inadequate response from law enforcement agencies to address and respond to that violence. We've done two reports on Jamaica, and the second report that came out in 2013 showed an improvement from the report we had done 10 years earlier, in that there was less evidence of law enforcement officials being complicit in violence, and some efforts to address diversity issues within the police force. And indeed, you know, there have been a number of training initiatives, and many of the embassies, including the Canadian embassy, have been quite proactive in that work. But still, people feel very vulnerable. They feel that they're not protected by the police. In some instances, they report violence to the police and are treated with indifference or, in the worst cases, contempt, and see no option but to leave the country and seek a better life elsewhere. There's a case coming before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that's looking at the situation in Jamaica because of the existence of the law and because of the high levels of violence that people, LGBT people, experience in Jamaica. And then I think another interesting aspect around patterns of migration is that people might leave a hotspot. Say, for example, Uganda. Mm-hmm. When the Anti-Homosexuality Act passed there, the aftermath of that act was incidents of violence, of people being thrown out of their homes, of a peak in discrimination against LGBT people. And a lot of people, LGBT people, fled to neighboring Kenya. Now, Kenya is not ideal, and certainly the refugee camps are far from ideal for LGBT people, and indeed some had very negative experiences there. But it seemed to be better, a better option than staying in Uganda. And another example was in Gambia, where the Gambian president made very inflammatory statements against LGBT people, saying that he would slit their throats. And his secret police also rounded up a number of gay and lesbian people and imprisoned them for a period of time. And in the aftermath of that clampdown, a number of individuals fled to neighboring Senegal. And Senegal is not a welcoming place for LGBT people, but at that moment, it was safer than facing being imprisoned in Gambia. So we see those kinds of regional migrations. And then South Africa, of course, is seen to be a haven because of its legal framework that's unique in the continent, is that there's guaranteed equality in terms of the constitution for LGBT people. But it's not that welcoming to foreigners. There's a problem of xenophobia, and also there's high levels of violence that are experienced by LGBT people. So it's not the utopia that people who are fleeing from other countries in sub-Saharan Africa expect to find. And in fact, many are very disappointed. But in some instances, it's a safer haven, despite those difficulties, than the countries from which they have fled.
I think when we were talking with Michael Castasola of UNHCR, we were talking about when folks even get to Canada, and Canada's often painted as the shining beacon of places to go. But when they get here, you know, within the gay community, there's quite substantial racism. And, you know, it's not as welcoming as, you know, people might like to think. Certainly not to the degree, I think, that you might see in other countries. But, you know, it's hard to paint the perfect picture. But you're right. I think what you've really demonstrated is that folks leave areas where they're most at risk to places where they're still at risk, but it's, you know, it's slightly safer than. Which, you know, is terribly unfortunate, and I think captures more of the migrations that we're seeing in the world.
It's kind of understandable, though. If you put yourself in their shoes, if you're in most of the countries in Africa are linguistically pluralistic, but they have lingua francas at the national level. So if you're in a Swahili-speaking country, regardless of your home language, and there's a neighboring country which is less violent but still kind of violent, but you're definitely not going to go to prison, you're just going to, you know, have bad daily life, but it's still a Swahili-speaking country, it's going to be way more appealing and way less frightening than picking up and going off to a completely different world, basically. I mean, it kind of makes sense in a very human way to go to the neighboring country, even if it's not perfect.
But also it speaks to the means of being able to move around as well. I think that's an important point of privilege to point out, that people don't have the capacity just to pack up and ship on out. At least most people don't have that. And of course the West isn't as welcoming as we'd like to think. In Europe there's a very substantial anti-immigrant sentiment right now. How is that? Does that hamper any efforts to kind of fight these issues on the ground at the international level? You know, is it easy or hard to work with Western, in particular European countries, to get advocacy against some of these laws?
You know, the advocacy from Europe is often a double-edged sword, partly because it can have a negative consequence. Because for example, you know, to use a Canadian example, when the Canadian Foreign Minister pointed out to the Ugandan Speaker of the House that the anti-homosexuality bill was you know, totally contrary to human rights and should not be enforced. Now, of course, that was a valid point to make, and of course that is the case. But she then went back to Uganda and spun it to say, we are no longer a colony. We're not going to listen to what the West has to say. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ensure that that law is fast-tracked through Parliament. So a kind of negative reaction to what is seen to be a kind of Western interference has exactly the opposite effect of what it was intended to do. This was, you know, several years back when the law was briefly passed and then mm-hmm. was declared unconstitutional, fortunately enough. But that is, you know, so it's always, it's you know, countries always need to be careful as to how they conduct that kind of advocacy. Is that I think there's a willingness from many countries in Europe to speak out around anti-LGBT legislation, but they also need to be cautious and do so in a way that's not going to put activists and LGBT people at further risk. And we often see that, you know, it comes up in terms of aid conditionality, is that there have been occasions in which there are threats of aid cuts or implication that aid might be cut if laws aren't changed. And that often, you know, puts LGBT community at further risk, because they not only are they blamed for a whole range of social ills, mm-hmm. they're also blamed for the cut in aid. So, you know, it has a negative consequence for activists in that country. So I think the principle is it's always important to take advice from activists working in country, because they're best placed to know what the situation is. So before we issue a statement or bring out a report, we always work very closely with activists, say, for example, in Uganda or Cameroon or Senegal or Nigeria, in order to understand what would help them and what would be harmful to them in terms of the work that we do.
And I think that's that kind of sentiment of empowering folks on the local ground is being echoed, not just by yourself, but by many, many other people. I was at the World First LGBT Policing Conference in Amsterdam, and it was a great event, and we had Nicholas Opayo of Chapter 4 Uganda. He's a human rights lawyer. He was speaking to, I mean, unfortunately, the timing of his speech was terrible, because he was speaking to how there was an international reputation of Uganda being the most homophobic place in the world. And he was saying that, you know, simply that's not true. There have been multiple pride events that they're doing a bit incognito, but, you know, it's happening, and there's been in some cases, police protection, and things are improving. Unfortunately, the day he was giving that speech, later that evening, the venue for Uganda's Pride was raided by Uganda police. But luckily, I mean, he was at the Conference of International LGBT Police Officers and was able to rally international support, but in a way that made the most sense to them. So getting best practices in policing from around the world and kind of really showing Ugandan police... Yeah. You know, this is a more effective tool, as opposed to saying the tool you're using is incorrect.
And I think that's also a very good example that brings us back to your earlier point about solidarity and alliances, because Uganda is a very good example of a country where they have built very strong alliances with women's groups and other marginalized groups to rally against the Anti-Homosexuality Act and the Pornography Act, and the act that criminalizes transmission of HIV. So, you know, there's been a good coalition politics there that's broader than the LGBT community, that's been very successful in advocating against these kinds of repressive and discriminatory legislations.
And I think that collective initiative is perhaps a lesson that we can learn here in Canada. I know that working on the ground in many Canadian cities, LGBT pride groups and LGBT groups on the whole have become incredibly isolated. There's less collaboration with folks working on HIV or with women's groups. You know, perhaps, you know, we can flip the tables here, and there are important lessons that we as the West can learn that's happening in places like Uganda.
Yes, I think that's right. Certainly, I see my perspective on LGBT rights coming out of a South African situation where it's a very broad alliance and in part of the anti-apartheid movement that embraced LGBT rights. So it was always part of a broader human rights movement and not something that was advocated for in isolation from the broader human rights struggles that were taking place in South Africa. So I think that, and you know, that accounts for the fact that there's sexual orientation within South Africa's constitution, precisely because of that broad coalition politics that emerged in the late 1980s and early 1990s. So I think there are definitely lessons to learn from other parts of the world in terms of thinking about our strategies and approaches to changing laws and policies and for addressing issues within North America, Europe, etc.
Well, I think we've certainly demonstrated over the course of today's show that, GLBT refugees aren't coming just from Syria, that they are migrating from all over the world, usually, as mentioned, to neighboring countries, as makes the most sense. But also, I am thrilled that we've exemplified yet again that it is not all doom and gloom, that there is, a lot of really good work happening, and a portion of that very good work is happening with yourselves at Human Rights Watch. So thank you so much for joining us. I'm afraid that we've just about run out of time.
Thank you for the invitation. I really enjoyed it.
Excellent. Thank you. So we'll be back just after this song to wrap up. This is Bright Light, Bright Light, who is Welsh, so a little bit of hometown pride there, featuring Elton John, All in the Name, and we'll be back just after this.
All in the name of being somebody.
One, two, three,
four.
What?
You're tuned to CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa.
And that is just about all we have time for this week. You wanted to make a quick note in terms of men versus women?
Yeah. Throughout the episode, like as people said things, I would look it up because that's how I roll. And something that I noticed is a lot of the laws that we were speaking about, they apply differently to men and women, that there are more laws against men in Africa than women. And there's many countries that have never had any laws against female homosexuality.
Well, this came up in a conversation a couple of weeks ago where the very idea of a lady doing things with another lady is just unthinkable.
Yeah.
So as a result, they didn't think about it. you know, and that speaks to more. But next week, in the last week of our Refugee Month, we have Capital Rainbow Refuge coming in and talking to us about how can you practically on the ground help. My favorite example is buying a frying pan. I know that when I moved out from my parents' place, I could really have used a frying pan. And it's just really practical tips like that. So it should be very, you know, very good conversation about how the folks listening can really, really help.
Mm-hmm.
If you've missed any of our Rainbow Refugee Month specials, check it out, velvetstudio.ca. And there is a slider right on the homepage that will take you right to where you need to go. But that's all now. This is 16 Shades of Blue by Tori Amos to play us out. Thank you for listening.
See you next week.
Are you telling me it's over, disintegrating, lost, and there's nothing I can do? Before you drop another verbal bomb, can I arm myself with Cezanne 16 shades of blue? As my heart is slowly ripping into pieces, disconnecting from the circuits of my mind, you'll get over it. This could be a lucky day, but my cables, they are surging, almost overloading.